Hello, and welcome to the Inside AVs podcast for December the 4th, 2020. This is episode number 35. Today, we'll be talking about charging networks, the Ford Mustang Mach-E Performance Edition debuts, the Nikola Badger deal is dead, Hyundai's next-gen EV platform has been revealed. I'm Dominic Ioni, Inside EVs editor and Inside EVs forum moderator. Joining us today, we have Tom Malogny, Inside EVs editor and YouTube and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge with Tom Malogny. We also have Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, which is available on all your usual podcast platforms. And of course, we have Kyle Connor from the Out of Spec Studios YouTube channels. He also puts together our superb videos for the Inside EVs YouTube channel. Go subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications. And finally, we have a special guest today, for a little while at least. Dedrick Roper is the Director of Public and Private Partnerships for ChargePoint, and we'll be talking to him for a bit about public charging. So welcome, gentlemen of the panel and ladies and gentlemen of the audience. So let's kick this thing off by talking about public charging. Some people can charge their cars in their driveways and garages, but if they want to drive beyond the range of the car, if they have to park in the street or in a parking lot somewhere without anything to plug into, they're going to need a public charger. And public charging is also a big deal when it comes to making car buying decisions. Lots of people have purchased a Tesla because it has a pretty well-disputed high-power network that requires zero fuss to use. Just pull up, plug in, and all the billing happens automatically. For non-Tesla owners, the public charger landscape has been trickier. So to kick things off, Dedrick, can you tell us what are the top things or maybe top several things that that charging networks have to do to give people the confidence that if they buy an EV, they'll have a convenient way to keep it fueled? And welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy Friday, guys. Dominic, you said it. The majority of charging occurs at home. So it's about 80%, with some spilling over into workplace. But you're absolutely right. Public charging is essential to ensure driver confidence. People typically don't buy the car for their daily needs. They buy it for that edge case, the long road trip for vacations or, the trip to grandma's. So having that public infrastructure network be highly visible and available and easy to use is important to instill driver confidence. But I really just want to, touch on there is a change in the fueling behavior with an electric vehicle. You typically charge where you're spending long periods of time at work. If you're running errands at a retail store, having that opportunity there it helps promote driver confidence. So having lots of dots on the map is important. Making sure you're filling gaps and really making sure those chargers are highly visible. It goes a long way to instill that driver confidence.
That was something I've noticed in talking to some of our OEMs. That doesn't seem to be a big emphasis on signage around charging stations, like the branding. I would think that'd be like a huge opportunity, and it doesn't seem like people are really focused on that at all. Do you get that at all?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a missed opportunity on a lot of sites, again, to bring that driver awareness. I think, developers are doing a great job with on-site signage, but as far as wayfinding or highway signage, there are a lot of areas for improvement. There are some DOTs that now have programs that will install those signs on the highways. Folks are used to seeing the gas station sign and seeing where they could, what are the different stops you could make off the highway. So there are some states starting to roll out programs that guide drivers from the highway to the charging site. And it's especially critical in those rural applications. So along the corridor highways, where, a driver is, they can use an app. There are some new technologies, in-car dash, navigation systems. ChargePoint just announced we're integrated into Apple CarPlay. So now, you know, those things will get better in time. But for folks that don't have those capabilities in their cars, highway signage is really critical. I think that's, you know, if we could put more emphasis on that signage, it would, you know, further increase driver confidence that, there is sufficient infrastructure out there for them to charge their vehicles.
Right. Like gas stations have those huge signs that, you know, you can see from, you know, half a mile away, and like charging stations, there's nothing equivalent to that yet. But anyway, so I'm sure the rest of you all have some questions that you can ask. Maybe Tom, do you want to kick things off?
Or sure. So
maybe Didrik has
I was just going to say we just finished a really cool site in Fresno, California with Chevron. That huge sign that you can see from the highway, they actually incorporated EV charging into that sign. So, you know, obviously it's a first step, but, you know, the fueling industry is starting to buy into this and see the value in, promoting EV charging to drivers. So positive sign, positive step in the right direction.
Right on. Sorry, Tom.
No, sure. So, you're on. One of the things that I'd like Didrik to talk a little bit about is how ChargePoint has a little bit of a different business model than some of the other large networks in the U.S. Now, ChargePoint was very early to this. They had the most charging stations installed in the country. Most of them are level two. They're just now, seemingly the last couple of years, to begin to expand DC fast charge. But what ChargePoint does that's different than, say, Electrify America or EVgo is they sell their equipment to site operators, and they then manage the back end of it, the payment systems and control that. But the owner of the property actually is responsible to manage the charging stations. I know this firsthand because I actually own a DC fast charger and a level two charger on the ChargePoint network on a property that I own in Montclair, and I manage that. But one of the things we see frequently is people complaining on forums and even on Inside EV comments that, ChargePoint stinks. I showed up to this site and three of the chargers didn't work, and nobody cares about them, and the connector's laying on the ground. But they don't realize that ChargePoint has no control over that. They sell the equipment to the property owner, and it's their job to then keep the equipment functioning and working. They own it. So, Didrik, could you talk a little bit about the challenges of having that different business model and maybe why that's a better model for ChargePoint to use?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Tom. Like you said, we're pretty vertically integrated. We, develop our hardware, develop the software, and then we also provide 24/7 driver support. So really, we want to enable the host to customize their charging service offering for their specific use case. So ChargePoint's not making money off selling electrons, right? We're selling the hardware, and then we make money on software subscriptions and also extended maintenance and warranties. So we offer a package called Assure, which is on the screen right now, guarantees 98% uptime of your charging station. We work with O&M partners across the nation that can come out and service that charger for you. And if a driver has any questions, they call into our dedicated customer support team. So we are, kind of the foundation for that charging offering. But ultimately, it is the site host, the charging station owner's decision on which services they subscribe to. Now, we always have our software on the chargers that enables things like remote diagnostics, remote start and stop. There's a bunch of great features that you can use within the software. Like you said, Tom, it's ultimately the charging station owner's decision as to whether they buy that Assure package, how they maintain the parking spaces, et cetera. So there's a bit of an education on that. Same thing with pricing. ChargePoint does not set the price on the chargers. So we try to build in some messaging in the app and on the screen. Price set by station owner. So we try to make it really clear, but there is some misconception into how we the ChargePoint business model. And just to just speak to some of the merits of that business model, it really has allowed us to grow at an exponential rate. You know, much like Airbnb is the largest hotelier industry, but doesn't own any hotels. You know, ChargePoint is the largest network, but we own very little of our own charging stations.
Sure. If you don't mind, a quick follow-up or question on that. Now, you are the largest network, but it's mostly level two charging stations, which I believe you have very robust units, which is why I went in that direction for my own property. But I think it's also that model is going to hold back your expansion of DC fast because unlike, say, we mentioned Electrify America or EVgo, they go into a site and they'll install four or five DC fast chargers, and it might cost $300,000 or $400,000 to do so. It's going to be harder to find individuals, property owners, property managers that are willing to put out that kind of money when, for the foreseeable future, they'll never make their money back. You know, it's a losing proposition installing a $400,000, let's say, DC fast charge site, because it'll take many years to recoup your money, if ever. So I think that might hold back DC fast charge expansion on the ChargePoint network. It's why most of your network, I think, is level two now. Is there anything on the horizon, maybe some kind of partnerships that we might be looking forward to see where you can get some of your ultra high powered, say the Express units, which are really good DC fast charge units? We just don't have too many of them out there because it's hard to find site owners to invest that kind of money into that. Is there any maybe chance on the horizon that we might see a different business model so that you can get more of these out there?
Yeah. Good points. DC fast charging is a little, it's more expensive than level two. And, like you said, Tom, there are concerns about the operating costs and things like that. But I will say the port growth is happening. Released our first DC fast charging product, built in-house last year sometime. And I think, we're over 1,000 units already. You touched on it. It is those partnerships. So we've been working on, the urban core. Those networks are getting built out. There's good use cases there. There's fleet vehicles, transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft announcing, plans to go electric. There are opportunities in the urban core. But once you get away from there, that's when you start to run into some of those larger challenges. And what I've seen is those partnerships come into play pretty significantly. And it varies by location. You might have municipal utilities or co-ops chipping in, the local municipality, universities. Just to give an example, we're working with Tennessee Tech University in the upper Cumberland region of Tennessee, where the university is getting involved. The utility is getting involved. They're leveraging grant funds. They've partnered with transportation network companies, OEMs, bringing all these different groups together to provide their own value and make that those charging sites happen. So I don't know that there's a silver bullet across the board. It really does matter on a site-by-site basis, utility-by-utility basis. And then also, what kind of incentives are there? We still have the federal tax credit, the Volkswagen settlements dispensing money across the nation, the Biden team, talking about significant investments in infrastructure. So I think we're going to continue to see, kind of these partnerships play a critical role at the local level, and the network will continue to build itself that way.
Cool. Hey, Kyle, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I'm very curious about this. ChargePoint sells the units, obviously, to who's installing them. Do you guys provide any insight or recommendation as to charging power specifically for DC charging, but also for level two? Most of the level twos are 30 amp at business voltage, 208. It's just like, 6 kilowatts or so, which is pretty low, especially as you can just plug in a 60 amp breaker and pull 48 amps. So is there a push for higher power AC charging, and then the recommendation to utilities or private businesses installing DC chargers to do more than just that 50 kilowatt? Because on the CPE 250s, I've used them on a couple road trips now, never had an issue once activating them, super reliable, nice and quiet. But some of them are only 50 kilowatts. And I'm like, this thing can do 125 or more. So where does ChargePoint come into at least say, look, you know, we have bigger battery, new EVs. We have Kyle out there road tripping everywhere. Just joking. But we need, you know, we need to up the power levels a little bit
here. Yeah. So what can you guys do to help? We rolled out flexible power in our home unit. So the amperage is slipping my mind right now, but it's basically a flexible amperage that you can set at the time of installation. So, you know, higher power level two charging. There might be some other things on the horizon that I can't talk about in a level two space, but in the DC space, we do have, you know, the CPE 250, which as a standalone unit is a 62.5 kW charger, but when installed in pairs, they can share that power. So up to 125 kilowatts, as you explained. And then on our website, there's also, you know, our Express Plus line, which will be released in the somewhat near future. There you go, up to 500 kilowatts of energy. So we're definitely focused on, you know, higher power, but higher power isn't everything. I know everyone wants higher power, but if you really look at the charging profiles of today's EVs, like the infrastructure that's out there today is really suitable for the bulk of the vehicles on the road. So
that I totally agree with the cars today. You know, we still have a lot of Leafs on the road. We still have i3s. This infrastructure lasts for 10, 15, 20 years. So my only thing is I'd love to see higher power chargers, especially as we see Taycan, for example, hold 270 kilowatt to 50%. You don't want to be a Taycan owner sitting at 62.5 kilowatt, or even some of these CPE 250s. I've seen multiple limited to 50 kilowatt. Just up here in Colorado, for example, we have a 50 kilowatt unit, which is, I'm not sure why they would limit it, because there's four stations. You think it'd have the power, but you know, there's so many, opportunities to drive what the manufacturers will put in the cars. It's sort of the chicken before the egg thing, where if you have the infrastructure to support 300, 400, 500 kilowatt chargers, then the manufacturers may go and actually make those cars. But if there's no infrastructure, there's no reason for them to design them. This is how I've always viewed it. Have you found this in your partnerships with electric automakers that, you know, they're really waiting for the network to catch up before they increase the car's charging capacity?
Yeah,
or is it the other way around?
So I just want to circle back to, you know, Tom's comment about the cost of, you know, owning and operating a DC fast charger. You know, you really don't want to overspend today because the operation can be a bit challenging. So what we suggest to hosts that are installing DC fast charging, like upon the initial installation, prepare your site for future expansion and growth. So that means running the right size conduit so you can upsize that down the road, pouring your transformer pad so that it's large enough to accommodate a future transformer. And what we do, you know, what that does is it enables your site to expand cost effectively when utilization demands that. So that can either be more power, more chargers, you name it. But, you know, preparing that site the proper way up front with the right conduit, the right, you know, the right pads, et cetera, will really save you some money in the long run. So, you know, if I was talking to a host, I wouldn't come in and say, hey, overbuild your system now. I would say right size it for today. Take a look at the data over time. And then, you know, we can help you assess the right time to add more chargers or add more power.
Right on.
Can I ask, maybe it's not a ChargePoint specific question, but just you with deep knowledge of the EV world, as we get into that next phase of the adoption curve of, you know, the people who care about kilowatt hours and voltages of packs diminish and just people end up renewing their lease and happen to get, you know, an electric car. What can we do to make everyone who is a non-Tesla owner, because I do want to recognize, as I don't own a Tesla, but the supercharging network is so frictionless and so easy to use. And it is just, hey, you bought a Tesla. It's like owning an Apple phone. Give us your credit card. You'll buy something from the, you know, the App Store and we'll bill you. Plug in and Tesla will bill you. What can we do for the vast majority of people who aren't going to buy those premium cars? You know, what's your opinion on making that process as like slick and simple? We've seen Apple CarPlay integrating ChargePoint here in the UK now. That really helps. But, you know, in your opinion,
yeah, yeah. So I'd say over the last few years, we've been, you know, working on that problem with the other, you know, other networks in the industry. And it's through roaming agreements. So it's a peer-to-peer agreements with other networks that makes the charging experience seamless for the driver, no matter what network they work on. So we've executed, you know, at least five of such roaming agreements, you know, in the U.S. So what that does is it really makes a frictionless charging experience for the driver, no matter what, you know, network they belong to or what RFID card or app they use. You know, they can just come up and use, you know, their normal card and then on any, you know, any network and, you know, be able to, you know, charge their cars pretty easily. Also, you know, other payment options such as, you know, contactless payments like Apple Pay, Android Pay, you know, that functions like that really make things, you know, easy for the masses.
Yeah. And just a follow-up question on that, again, might not be ChargePoint specific, but just your opinion, you know, as an expert, how do you see that sort of charging, not charging of plugging in, but the billing process just becoming as easy as possible? So I've got a key fob from my electricity provider. They're quite forward thinking, and my electricity company's done some deals with not many but a few networks here in the UK, so that if I go to those charging stations, I can wave the key fob from my home electric account and then it just goes onto my home bill. So at the end of the month, I pay for my home heating and my cooking and my driving as well, and that works really well for me, just to think of my energy usage. And so my mobility tends to get folded into my energy usage. No longer am I thinking of, well, that's my home and that's the gas station. How can we make the billing process for people as simple as possible? Of course, I know plug and charge comes into that, and ISO 15118 or whatever it's called. But how, you know, if we were to paint a dream ticket here, how good can things get in terms of making life easy?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not a product manager, but I think that the foundation is there with the roaming agreements. You know, all that billing transactions is happening in the background, unbeknownst to the customer, with no additional fees or you know, any other, you know, things to worry about. So while I can't, you know, completely comment on, you know, what, you know, products might be developed in the future, it seems like we have a good system in place now that can be leveraged for additional efficiencies in the future.
Okay, and if I can, just one final question. Like we're often, because we have an expert on the line here, like we're often told like fast chargers are great. And I kind of have this obsession with, well, that's great, but what about if I went to a car park and it had, you know, 2000 spaces, and each of those had like a really low powered plug. I've seen pictures of them in China and things. And I kind of wonder, we need someone to do it. Like what's your opinion on that balance of, because the fast charge is really sexy and we love to, you know, if you do own a great car, right. It's great to talk about them. I own a Renault Zoe that charges at 22 kilowatts max, and it's only on AC anyway. And you know, we're lucky we've got a lot of AC posts around here. But I'm kind of interested in the idea of, but what if I went somewhere or paid for public parking when I went to the office, and my car was going to be stationary for 8 hours, 10 hours? You know, what if there was like 2,000 just domestic plugs? Does that work for EV drivers?
Yeah, I mean, I think you lose some of the functionality from a site owner perspective, and you know, some of the control that you have over the energy on site. So while I think it's, you know, it's feasible, there are, you know, numerous manufacturers and numerous software offerings that have that power limiting capability that you're talking about through software. So you know, it's not a one size fits all. You want to have that modularity and the ability to, you know, change the power levels, you know, depending on the use case, because, you know, while it may be a long-term lot today, you know, who knows, you might, you know, charge in some fleet vehicles there and want to be able to charge them at a higher rate. So I think today's hardware and software really enables that and can be deployed at scale. And, you know, you might be thinking, well, you know, there might be some limitations on the grid. Well, you know, through various software capabilities, you're able to overload panels, overload circuits, and still, you know, provide that same consistent experience that you would have at any public charger.
Right on. Hey, so we're kind of short on time, but I have a few questions from Twitter and Facebook. If I could just list them off and maybe hit them real quick. What do you think, Dedrick?
Yep.
All right on. Okay.
This is cool.
So,
I like it.
We put out some questions on social media and got a bunch here. So we'll just try to run through some real quick. So, and you've kind of answered some of these, you know, so don't feel like you need to spend a lot of time on them. So Mike Ernest asks, can they put chargers at gas stations?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're seeing a lot of interest from gas stations for DC fast charging. They're in the fueling business and there are more and more vehicles coming on the road, more commitments from OEMs. So, the fueling and convenience industry are, you know, really waking up to this opportunity. We're doing a lot of work with those industries.
Right. Hey, what's that? There's a new network of store. Actually, Martin, you probably know about this. Is it like GridPoint or something? They have a bunch of different stores with like multi vehicle charging and like a store.
Yeah, over here, it's it opens up in a couple of days.
Right.
It should have been November, but I think it got COVID-ed. But they they're called GridServe, and their philosophy is big charging stations, like filling stations, with solar canopies, a Tesla supercharging bank as well, plus their own, you know, their own hardware, a range of charging speeds, plus a coffee shop, a gym, somewhere to eat, get takeaway food. First one should be opening in a county called Essex in the next few days here. Of course, massively capital intensive, but they have, you know, they have some backers that see that as a business model. And again, you know, I think, you know, one is great, but we need many more, and just the investment is, you know, eye watering, and I wouldn't want to be writing those checks, but what they've done is amazing for the first one.
Well, I understand they have like 100 of those coming.
Yeah. So that's certainly the promise. It's just hugely, hugely expensive to build one, let alone hundreds. And then that, the ROI on it, I'll see if I can find a picture while we're talking, you know, the ROI on it is certainly a challenge in the short term. But I think if you're playing the long term game on this, then, you know, perhaps, you know, you're in a good position either for, you know, to generate some, oh, here we go, either generate some revenue on that or an exit or an acquisition, because you'll be in a really good position. But, you know, there's plenty of big energy companies that would want that kind of thing in their portfolio. So it's a smart business and they're doing really cool things. That's under construction, obviously.
Right. So this is kind of like the sort of the model that I could see get in the gas station companies, whatever, or oil companies, Exxon, et cetera, investing in, you know, if they really decide or understand that this is like the future, and if they want to be in the future in the business of distributing energy, this is kind of like a model they should be looking at.
And also reliability as well. So that as an EV driver, there's nothing worse than knowing that you're going somewhere with a low state of charge and there's one charger. Like, you know, but then when there's 30, you're like, okay, well, I can afford to be out one. And that's one of the things. Actually, there's a network over here called InstaVolt. They've got a really good reputation because they use ChargePoint hardware, which is all quite new. And actually, it's that hardware that if you turn up to, it's just always going to work at the moment. That's a benefit of being new, but it's you know, also testament to the hardware. That you know that it's not AC, but actually, you know what, it's probably, if I get there, it's going to work. We've got some legacy hardware here from early investors And, you know, you've got to keep spending money on updating that hardware, because now you turn up to it and it, you know, it kind of works, doesn't work. And that's a real frustration.
Okay. So let's move on to the next question real quick. Alexander Daniels asks, how do they monitor their charging locations for necessary maintenance? And in a similar vein, MD Volt asks, is there any new tech providing station operators the ability to detect station problems, failures, and initiate servicing immediately without human intervention, meaning that days don't go by until a stranded motorist reports a problem? Dedrick?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll speak to ChargePoint. Remote diagnostics and, you know, remote right. start and stop capabilities are core to our software offering. So, yes, you're able to, you know, see how your charge is performing from, you know, a mechanical perspective, but also like a network perspective, especially when you start to get into some rural communities. It's really, you know, can be challenging to get the proper sales signals out there. So all those capabilities are built into our software. As far as, you know, no human intervention, I don't know if the industry's quite there yet, but I could, you know, see it head in that direction. But as of today, you know, I could speak for ChargePoint. We have that full dedicated support service that's there 24/7 for drivers, as well as every business day for charging station owners.
Sweet. The Green Texan asks, are all of their stations going to become part of the plug and charge movement like Electrify America?
Again, yeah, I'm not a product development person. I'll have to defer on that question.
Okay. Sure. Okay. I'm not sure about this name. Alkalite Brome asks, when will our destination infrastructure flesh out? Museums, concert halls, ballparks, beaches, ski slopes, et cetera, et cetera. Places we might drive 200-300 miles round trip in a day, add 100 miles while at an event rather than on the way home. So yeah, asking about, so when people go out in their general, you know, going to commute, going to work, coming back, you have an idea how many miles you're going to use. But he's asking, I guess, about, you know, charging at destinations.
That work is being done there. You know, we're deploying in more, you know, corridor locations across the U.S. And, you know, yeah, I just say it's happening piece by piece. There are, you know, other models out there that are, you know, specifically target these types of locations. So, you know, it's coming.
What I'd say. Okay. Let's just go with one more quick one. Alex Gombert asks, how are they working to streamline the install process at apartment complexes?
Yeah, so, apartments can be challenging, especially some of your older apartments with, you know, kind of older grids. So we provide, you know, full training for installation, but to the apartment application specifically, we've developed, you know, functionalities in our software that allow us to oversubscribe circuits and panels. That's what really hampers development in multifamily properties. So now being able to put more plugs on that same circuit and serve more residents, that's what's really opening that up. And then, you know, back to the DC side, we're now beginning to see pilots and deployments within multifamily clusters of DC fast chargers, so that the drivers in the surrounding community can now come and charge at that hub, you know, just because, you know, some of these buildings are just really old and a bit cost prohibitive to upgrade those panels and such. But yeah, as far as like installation support, how to do it, you know, we have national partners that are well versed in our product. And even if you're not an O&M partner, you can go to our website and get training on how to install our chargers.
Right on. Well,
I want to follow up with a quick comment, Tom, sure, about the service. I think MD Volt had the tweet about remote service. One thing I will give ChargePoint credit for is whenever there's a complaint about my site, whenever there's a service issue, I get a phone call. So if somebody shows up and can't plug in and they report it to ChargePoint, I immediately get a phone call from support saying, hey, somebody was at your station and they couldn't get it to work. So they are, ChargePoint is on top of things as far as notifying the property owners when there's some sort of an issue detected with the equipment. Now, it's then on the property owner's plate to actually fix it or address the issue or even take a look at it, you know. And the funny thing is, sometimes I'll get notified that somebody attempted to use my DC fast charger, which is a CCS DC fast charger. And then I'll find out later it was a Tesla owner and they couldn't figure out how to get it to work. Well, because it won't work. You know, there's actually a CCS to Tesla connector that's been developed now. I'm supposed to be getting an early copy of it to test it out soon for the US market. There was a European Tesla CCS connect adapter that's been floating around for a year or so now, but we didn't have one for CCS one type one here in the US, but evidently a company in China has developed it and we should be testing it out soon. So I just wanted to give ChargePoint a little credit there. They have very good customer service. Whenever there's an issue detected on my site, I get a phone call from them saying, hey, go check this out.
So I'd like to thank you, Dedrick, for coming in and spending some time with us today. I guess we probably could have done a whole show on this like easily. Man, time kind of went by. But thank you very much. And I guess if anyone wants to get in touch with you, want to tell us how to do that?
Yeah, you can reach out to me at grants@chargepoint.com. Easiest way to get in contact with me, grants@chargepoint.com.
Right on. Great. All right. So we'll probably talk to you afterwards. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. Oh, he's gone. Okay. So, there's still a bunch of stuff to talk about today. So let's go from charging to winter tires. If you live where it gets below freezing, you should have winter tires. Even if there's like no snow to deal with, that's because the rubber in summer tires and to some extent all seasons is not really formulated to deal with cold weather. And they become hard and they lose traction, stopping abilities, making your car less capable than in warmer months. I understand, Kyle, that you've put some new rubber on a couple of EVs, and I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about those and maybe how hard it is to find low rolling resistance winter tires.
Yeah, so for a series that I'm doing on the Out of Spec Reviews channel, I wanted to do some tire testing, at least, you know, dip our toes into it, see if people were interested. And man, have we gotten so many emails and questions about this, but we won't go all into it in this episode. Right. I think we'll do a roundup at the end of the winter. But two different vehicles, two different tires. So the first, we own a BMW i3, of course, and the i3 has these little tiny like 155 section tires in the front, 175s in the rear. It's a staggered from the factory. And good luck trying to find a selection of tires available in that size. It's pretty much one or two tires. And I actually reached out to Bridgestone. I was like, how hard was it to make these tires? And we're going to be doing a whole video with one of their engineers that's recorded on Out of Spec Reviews. So make sure check that out. But basically, we got the Bridgestone LM500 winter tires, which are Blizzax. And these things were pretty cool. Now, the i3 BMW, I should say, recommends that you go with a square setup. So we went with 155 section tires. That's the width in millimeters on all four corners. So in the snow, which is crazy to think about, these little pizza cutters actually worked out pretty well. We took the car up into the mountains the other day and found some steep hills and just floored it straight up the hills and it crawled its way up. Whereas the other set, the original set, which were also Bridgestone tires, basically got stuck in the driveway. So I was very impressed with that. And, that's the i3. And then the Tesla, we are doing a series called like the ultimate winter tire setup. We just did our first video on Out of Spec Motoring for that car, but the rest will be on reviews. And this car has the 18-inch Martian wheels on the car. And then I went with the Nokian Hakkapeliitta R3s, which I just think sound really cool. So it makes it sound awesome. Right. They're Finnish tires. And, you know, supposedly from all of the testing and stuff, these are just the winter tire to go for. They're not really that known in the U.S., but in like the Nordic countries, everyone runs these. So I went with the most aggressive tire that's not studded because, again, still a lot of my driving is going to be on dry pavement. But as soon as we head up into the mountains, it's going to be on deep snow, ice. So, Martin, if you play that video through, you can see us rallying it through some of the beautiful roads here in Colorado. We have awesome trails that we can shred around. And, yeah, I got to tell you, these things were crazy impressive in the snow. The braking performance especially was just like, are we on pavement or are we on snow and ice? It really was impressive. So
that's great.
A lot of people have been asking us to compare to all season and all weather tires. These will all come in due time.
Right on. And Nokian is an interesting company because they also make summer tires, and but they're known for the winter tires. So because they're not really known for the summer tires, you can get good deals in the US on their summer tires. And I actually have Nokians on a vehicle of mine, and I actually really like them.
But, yeah, they're super, yeah, Florida, super high quality.
I don't really need to worry about. Yeah, I'm in Florida. I don't really need to worry about snow. But yeah, we need to do some good tire show sometime because it's a big deal. All right, so let's hit some news.
I just picked up a set of winter tires for my Model 3, and I got a fantastic deal. I got them from somebody who had a Model 3 and had to sell it, and he bought the winter tires and never even put them on. And somebody local, so I got the whole set for $200, and they're brand new. So nice. It's like what it costs for one tire. I scored. And so I'm going to be putting those on when I get my new Model 3. I'm supposed to get it next Wednesday. So less than a week, I'll have the car. I'm immediately taking it to get wrapped. So it's going to take another 3 or 4 days. But the following week, I'll have the winter tires on it. And looking forward to, you know, getting it out once it snows here and doing a review on those also.
That'll be sweet. What kind of tires are they?
The Michelins. I think they're I forget the exact.
Exact.
Yeah, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, probably the threes. They have different ones, but yeah, the Excise 3 is probably what those are.
Yeah, I didn't even fully vet the exact tire because when he said, "Yeah, just give me $200 for the set," I was like, "Yeah, like I don't care what it is. Yeah. They're brand new winter tires for what it costs to buy one. I think they're like $180 each. So, you know, I scored."
Yeah. All right. Let's get some news. So there's not a ton of news, but there's some good news this week. So Ford has revealed it has a Mustang Mach-E GT Performance Edition. We already knew they had a GT, but this other variant is even hotter. It's got the same 480 horsepower as a GT, but it's got 34 more torques. So up to 634 pound-feet of torque. That's a bit of difference. That bit of difference is enough to lower the 0 to 60 time by about half a second. The GT does it in just under 4 seconds, they say. And the GT Performance Edition does it in 3.5 seconds. Kyle, what more can you tell us about the spicy pumpkin? I call it a pumpkin because in the photos,
I like that the spicy here. Pumpkin. Well, I would say spicy is absolutely the word for this thing. I mean, look, you're on par 0 to 60 with Model Y. And if we know anything about Ford up to this point, I think it's going to be faster than that. And I think they will beat the current Model Y claims. Now, will Tesla go out and just turn up the dial to 11? Sure, probably. But pretty cool that we kind of have this battle. You know, the only downside for going with the spicy pumpkin is the range loss. And it's probably due to the wheel and tire combination. They're putting sticky rubber, larger wheels. It's 234 miles EPA. We'll have to see what that equates to in real world. We might see a big gap on paper from 270 to 234, but in real life, it may actually be closer. These are just the oddities of EPA testing cycle, but we know we're going to get massive brakes, good suspension, racing seats, and it's going to be track capable. So you'll be seeing me shredding one of these things around a racetrack sometime middle of next year, whenever they roll out. And I cannot wait to give Ford back their car with no tires left.
So the regular GT gets 200. I think it gets 250 miles all right range. The regular GT.
Regular GT, I don't know offhand, but I know this one's, I believe, 234 miles of EPA rated range.
Yeah, I have 235 here, but yeah, that's
It might be for sure. Forgive me for being off by a little bit. Yeah, right in that region.
That's fine. Yeah. Tom, what do you think of this thing?
I think it looks awesome, and that cyber orange metallic looks fantastic. Yeah, that's right? You know, I had loved the blue GT look, but once I got one look at this, I was like, is it too late to cancel my Model 3 order now? Of course, this would be significantly more, so it's probably just stretched out of my budget a little bit, and plus I'd have to wait a while for it. But I think it looks fantastic, and I fully expected Ford to do this. I really did. You know, Ford, we've talked about this before in the podcast. I just love what they're doing with the Mach-E. They just keep making it better. It seems like every month or two, we get new news that's better news, that's more interesting news. You know, that Ford did a fantastic rollout, starting from the introduction out at the LA Auto Show, where they, you know, really put the whole brand on the line and had Bill Ford out there. And, you know, they invited tons of people and had the whole lineup of Mustangs all lined up next to this. You know, this is what you want to see from you know, automakers, and, you know, kind of like not what we see from GM, which is a little disappointing. But, you know, I love this new Performance Edition. And I love just everything what Ford's been doing since we first learned about the Mach-E. They've really treated this great, and I can't wait to get behind the wheel of these vehicles. I may own one in the future. We'll see. But it's absolutely not just the vehicle. What makes me really happy is how Ford is really doing this rollout. Everything seems to be just, you know, how you want to see an EV introduced. Ford's taking this serious, and that's good to see. Very few other legacy OEMs seem to be taking it serious. Volkswagen is, you know, they've got their whole brand behind the ID4. That's going to be their, you know, their next, you know, million car that sells millions per year. But very few other manufacturers, they're all kind of just saying, oh, yeah, we love EVs. We're going to be all EV by 2030. But like, you know, then they dip their toe in it. So, but Ford, with this vehicle here, they're all in, and that's good to see.
Right on. It also has the comes with a Ford Performance seat, I guess. And do you know, Kyle, if the GT comes with that, or if it's just the GT Performance Edition?
I think it's just the Performance Edition.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking to it. And this one also comes with 20-inch wheels.
It could be one where the GT gets a more aggressive seat, and then the Performance gets another level of aggressive seat. You know, these big OEMs have no problem going to make 14 seat designs and 9,000 grills for their vehicles. They have the capacity to do so. So we'll have to wait and see to test each configuration, of course.
Right. Yeah, and these seats are coming from Ford Performance, which is like the performance arm. They also make stuff for, you know, whatever in competition vehicles anyway. Yeah,
sure.
Tom?
Talking about the grill, that seems to be like the nicest adaptation of the Mach-E grill on this Performance Edition. Maybe, I don't know if it's the color, how it bounced, but it looks great. In some configurations and some colors on the Mach-E, the grill just, it doesn't work for me, but that works. I think that looks awesome. It looks aggressive, and it really looks cool. I don't know if it's the colors
that's the thing.
Different with it, but that just pops.
Right. The non-GT versions have.
Yeah, for me, what it is, I don't know if I can find a picture of it. It's the kind of outline of the grill. See, like that in the blue, I'm not sure about. It's that sort of weird black. And in photos, it never looks right. And also, in person, it looks way better. So there's something weird about the styling of the car. It depends on color. But yeah, you're absolutely right that special edition, because it's got that solid black, almost carbon fibery effect, just looks like that. Make all the cars look like that.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of when I saw like the body color on the front piece there. It's, I mean, it's grown on me a little bit more now. I appreciate it more now, but no, it looks gorgeous. I really do like the way this thing looks, especially with the black trim. Yeah.
This is such an interesting conversation because we get half of our comments are stop putting nose cones and grills on non-EVs. And then half of our comments are, well, we like the grill and the Mustang. And I'm pretty sure it's the same people. So, you know, we'll have to battle this one out on Twitter, I think. But right. If I was to get one, I actually think I like the orange more than the blue. They, you know, I think they'll have other colors too, but why would you even consider it? You should just get this or the blue if you're getting the hot one.
I kind of like the white, but anyway. So this comes standard 20-inch wheels and 19-inch brakes instead of 18-inch brakes. I'm like, I don't know how you put a 19-inch brake on that.
Yeah, looking at that, like that's got to be a typo. I don't know. You have a 1-inch for a caliper. There's no way. I think it probably has 15-inch rotors, and maybe they're measuring the entire braking system from the edge of the caliper to which I've never seen done before. But there's no way it has 19-inch rotors with 20-inch wheels. I just don't know. And maybe there's magic in there, but I don't see that happening.
Right. Yeah. I've assumed that's like the pad or whatever, or the whole assembly around the pad. Right caliper. Anyway, let's move on to the next thing. I mean, our time is crazy today. So this is the most boring headline ever, but it's really a pretty big deal. Hyundai introduces us to its EGMP platform. EGMP. So basically, they've just shown off the flexible skateboard that future EVs for the Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis brands will sit on. Basically, they're following the example set by Volkswagen with its MEB platform and to some extent GM. The idea is to engineer a skateboard that many hundreds of thousands of vehicles will eventually share. So there's like a commonality of parts here, which is a lot cheaper than building a platform for an SUV and a platform for a midsize sedan, et cetera. So this new platform will have the vehicles on it will have ranges of over 500 kilometers, that's 311 miles, on a single charge under the WLTP cycle. 0 to 60 could be as quick as 3.5 seconds, so right up there with the Mach E GT Performance Edition, eventually. And let's see, a top speed of 260 kilometers an hour. That's 162 miles an hour, which is, you know, plenty fast. 80% recharge should be possible in 18 minutes at 350 kilowatts or that's 800 volts. So that's a pretty big deal. That's a good number. Bidirectional charging. So they call it charge to load. Some people call it charge to vehicle to grid, but yeah. Also a 5-link suspension, which is really cool. Hopefully Kyle will tell us a bit about that. And rear motor with optional front motors and disconnect technology. And finally, it's got SiC silicone carbide components in the inverter for improved efficiency. So yeah, it's all some really good notes there. Tom, any comments about this right off the top?
Well, you know, we expect all the manufacturers to eventually go to some sort of a skateboard design like this, you know, follow Tesla's lead. Volkswagen came out with them. So, you know, that's not a surprise that the Hyundai group is doing this. What I like to see about this is two things. Number one, that they're exploring or they're going to be using 800 volt battery packs as well as 400 volt battery packs. So they're going in that direction also with the 800 volts. I think that was a big thing. And also the bidirectional charging that you talked about. I think those are the two things that I really took from this as being, okay, that's great. You know, they get it. They're you know, exploring, they're looking down the road at things we're going to be doing. Now, we'll never get to vehicle to grid if manufacturers don't start making cars that are capable of it. And, you know, I know they're saying, well, you know, there's not a lot of use of it yet because there's work that has to be done outside of the automotive industry in order to us to really be able to take advantage to vehicle to home or vehicle to grid. But somebody has to start first. You know, it's kind of like what Kyle was talking about before about the DC fast charge. Do we build chargers that are faster or do we build cars that can accept the power first. And if both sides wait for the other side, it never gets done. So it's good to see that manufacturers are saying, hey, this is going to be something that we use down the road. So we're going to start building it out now. And, you know, those are the two big things that I took from this. Of course, you know, 100 kilometers of recharge in 5 minutes. That's a great thing to be able to promote. A lot of people don't want to sit around even for 18 minutes to get to 80%. And you only need to do that if you're on a long road trip. But if you're super low and you just need to finish your day running errands, and you know, that 5 minute stop for 100 kilometers or 60 or so miles, that's going to resonate with people. That hey, you only have to stop for 5 minutes and you'll get, you know, more than your daily driving needs for most people. So those are the things that I took from this that are big. You know, the vehicle to grid stuff is going to be huge, and it's good to see that Hyundai's picking this up now.
Kyle, what do you like about this? Do you have a favorite vehicle that you think that's going to be have this underneath of it?
Well, that's what I want to talk about, actually. Something about this strategy has me a little worried. Now, granted, I'm a huge fan of this strategy, going with one basically skateboard platform, then adapting it to your entire model range. But I have to say, we haven't really seen this really in practice. It's going to be so difficult to tune and engineer the character of your different models off of one skateboard. Now, certainly there's things that you can do to make it drive differently here or there. But I think, you know, one of the benefits we've had in the past as a car enthusiast is I know that, you know, if you have a bespoke chassis for the car, it's built from the ground up to serve that purpose, and it's 100% optimized, versus having, you know, one platform and adapting it many ways. It from a cost perspective and a scalability perspective, I get all the benefits. It's just from a brand driving identity from a model range. And I think we can look at Volvo Group for the closest this. They have something called the SPOD, SPA, Scalable Product Architecture. They also have CMA, which is the Compact Modular Architecture. And you can drive a Polestar 1, and then a Volvo V90, which is their big station wagon to their sports car. They literally drive identically. I mean, very few differences. And it's all just suspension tuning. But I worry that, you know, once we start seeing this cross sharing of platforms, especially from Volkswagen to Ford with the MEB platform, for example, they may all have the same character. And it'll kind of just be like, here's the car. They all drive the same. What do you want it to look like? And that's fine for 99% of people. But for the car enthusiast, I still have to feel like I represent them a little bit. There's just going to be a little bit less of a driving identity to the different models. Now, this is a really good idea. Obviously, they're not going to design cars for the less than 1% over here. So I'm all on board with the eGUMP platform, and all looks really good. Love the 800 volt stuff. Everyone should just be doing this now. All for it.
Right on. So can you tell us a little bit about what advantage the five-link suspension is going to bring to it? Also, and just to address your former point, so they can have different length wheelbases, the different vehicles, and they'll have different weights of vehicle on top of that. So that will change the road feel somewhat. I don't know if it's enough to really make a difference for you, though.
Yeah, well, when you have a multi-link suspension set up, you know, you just have more adjustability and control of where that wheel and tire is going to go. And this is a way for them to tune in some of the character from their sporty versions to their higher ones. It's really hard to say. I've driven multi-link suspension setups that are complete crap, and I've driven some that are really good. So it's going to be all about how they tune and engineer it. The benefits are, first off, it should give you a little bit more of that solid ride quality feeling. It's going to, you know, give you a lot of control over the car. We've seen multi-link setups for a long time. It's nothing new, but typically in higher end vehicles, of course. And we'll see how it plays through. I hope they give this thing a really good drive. I'm excited to see what goes on top of it.
I'm looking forward to that Hyundai Prophecy. That's, I think, one of my favorites coming up. Okay. Martin, anything you want to say about this before we move on?
Yeah, I would just separate out the specs with the philosophy. And so although they've said, here's the new platform and it's, you know, going to charge at this speed, I think they do that for more consumer language. So, you know, plug in for this many minutes and get this much range. But we know that battery technology is improving all the time. So this is a platform, right? So this is about standardization and modularization. And so one of the huge things for me is that actually this is their future. This is their roadmap. Now, important to remember, all of their cars so far have been compromised cars, which is sometimes easy to forget because they're so crazy efficient. They're some of the best out there, like the Ioniq, right. Even the Niro and the Kona in electric variants. It's just witchcraft. They go too far. And for what, you know, for the electricity they use. But they are compromised cars. This is the first time that they've done it with a dedicated platform. And whilst they've got some good specs, that's all great. The key is here that they are using it in terms of supply chain management and, you know, calling up, you know, Dave's seat company or whatever. Can we get 10 of those? Can we get a million of those? It's a different conversation. So it's really important that car makers do this because it means they can launch models much quicker. And it means that there's a much bigger range. And it means that in 2025, that we have millions of EVs on the roads rather than hundreds of thousands. So the specs are good, but don't get too tied up on it because battery technology chemistry is improving all the time. The vehicle to load thing, they call it V2L or vehicle to load, whatever, is really interesting because at the minute, if you want to get juice out of a car, normally a CHAdeMO car, there's the wall boxes at the minute are £2,000-£3,000. They're crazy expensive, but Lucid have done this and now Hyundai and more will follow where all of the electronics are integrated into the car for the bi-directionality. And so no real purpose for that yet, but we will. It will be used, especially when you haven't got to stick a £3,000 wall box on your house to, you know, to charge up your home battery. When all that's integrated, we will find uses.
Sure. Yeah. Well, one last thing about this, I wanted to mention that the some owners have had of the Kona Electric and Niro EV have had problems with the motors and gearboxes and things. We're not exactly sure what the but they're being swapped out, you know, fairly, you know, significant percentages of people have had issues. So with this new platform, they've integrated the axles into the, I'm not sure how they call it now, the integrated axle, something they have an acronym for it and everything. And, you know, it looks great and it should fix up those problems. Except that, and if there is an issue with your axle, man, it's going to be expensive to have it replaced, I think. But anyway, that's maybe inside down the road kind of thinking. I just saw that integrated axle. It's like, it's kind of nice, but also more expensive to service, I think. But yeah. So, but moving along, we have some more news. GM, General Motors, and Nikola have signed an MOU, that's a memorandum of understanding, that supersedes and replaces the transaction announced on September the 8th of 2020, which was a deal for GM to buy into them and then build electric pickup trucks called the Badger for Nikola and put the GM's Hydrotech fuel cell technology into Nikola's transport trucks and also the Ultium batteries into the electric versions of Nikola's transport trucks. Well, forget all about that. Yeah, the Badger is dead, I'm afraid to say. Yeah, and that deal is pretty much dead. And they've settled on a memorandum of understanding, which to me is like the lowest level of any kind of a deal. You know, it's basically, you know, we
it's not even a prenup.
It's so bad. I feel bad for all of the Nikola Badger reservation holders that were convinced that they were going to get their truck. They were so into these things and we were all like, look, you're probably not going to get it. And there you go. Not going to get it.
I want to say
GM should list the names of their attorneys that did the due diligence. So we all should know never to contact these people for any work, because how did they not do due diligence on Nikola? And I mean, you know, how did they do their, you know, investigation and said, oh yeah, this is a company we should partner with. How does that happen? You know, it's amazing, you know, that GM's got a tremendous amount of egg on their face. In the beginning, we were looking at it and saying, well, GM has nothing to lose about this because they're not investing any money and they're going to get the ZEV credits from the sales. And geez, GM was brilliant with this. What a good deal. But now we realize why it wasn't a good deal. They actually look pretty foolish.
This is like seeing Brad Pitt on a dating app, and you know, and then when you actually meet them in person, I turn up, and it's at that point that you go, this is different, right? At the point of believing what Trevor said, and then you actually do the due diligence, and you go, hang on a minute. For years, you've been saying that you've got all your own technology, you've got all your own IP, you don't need anybody else. Nikola's going to dominate and show Tesla how it's done. And by the way, we're the best thing ever. And then the deal is announced where GM would build the factory, would build the car, would supply everything, and Nikola were going to just do the marketing and sell the thing. At that point, you go, well, the last 3 years have been BS. But at no point did GM go, oh, hang on a minute. That's not Brad Pitt. That's the guy from the podcast. No, I'm walking away. So we were
catfish.
Totally. We were so confused by this and how that few weeks must have gone for GM in the background of them going, what have we done? So this new agreement, memorandum of understanding, is just something that they could do to let the next 3 to 4 months go by, and then it will quietly go away. Nikola, if anything, will be a small-scale commercial truck development company until something happens there. But their mainstream vehicle isn't there. And without a mainstream vehicle, they aren't really worthy of, you know, the discussion level that they get.
Right. So this kind of takes a good proportion of whatever wind Nikola had in its sails out of them. I haven't checked their stock price in a day or two, but it was it had gone down significantly.
It went down at the announcement and it went back up again because it's being traded. So it's being traded by people who are making either day trades or they're trading the stock. It went down 20%, right, then 16%. It was like 2 days in a row. But then it went back up again. And you're like, well, what's...
Oh, did
this
it?
Is now... Ah. I don't understand. It's all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. Sometimes stocks will do weird things, man. I've seen some like zombie stocks go on for years. And I have a little emails, whatever, a little transaction happened with whatever stock from like, I don't know. It's a penny. It was a penny stock years ago. And it's like, you know, fractions of a penny stock now, but it doesn't die. But anyway, so yeah, let's move on to something else.
It's up over the month on month, still up. Anyway, good luck if you're an investor
$18. That's $18.90. Yeah, that's pretty low though, because it had been up to almost $40 at some point.
Yeah, and then earlier in the year it was crazy high. But if you are working at the company and you've got, you know, stock options, and that's part of your future, and it sucks for them.
Can I bring up something really quick? You know, the start of all of this was from Hindenburg's research firm, was really like the first, right? And they just went after Candy. So my little fun car, my favorite vehicle of the year, doesn't sound like it's going to happen as much as it did when back then. I mean, of course, they're saying stuff on the financial back end, which I am not briefed on. I won't speak to, but I know that they did not renew their contract with their PR firm last week, because I got an email from them saying, hey, sorry, we no longer represent Candy anymore. So you'll have to just reach out to the CEO of Candy America. And I was supposed to have a meeting with him, ask him all these questions about the cars. When are we going to get it? Is it going to be something we can actually drive? And I guess now they're going to have neighborhood electric vehicle versions, which is limited top speed, which I don't think need to go through any homologation or crash testing, and sort of not looking so great. And so I'm hoping they can turn it around, because, again, I like Tom and I said, we're getting one if we can buy one, and we're going to do some fun things with it. But at this point, we're not even sure if we can get it.
Well, keep us up to date on what happens there. That's kind of bizarre. So, Mini has teased a spicy version of the Cooper SE. No details yet, but it just so happens that Out of Spec just released a video about tracking the regular Cooper SE. So maybe he can tell us, but this car needs to be a true track star. I think we have some footage of it, Martin. It's got like the huge wing on the back. It's on the Nürburgring. Kyle, what's it? What does this car need to do to make it worthy of that big wing? Well,
for those who don't know, I'm the biggest Mini fan out there. Tom, also as part of the Mini Electric story from the beginning, actually, he was one of the drivers of the original yep. Mini E. And so Tom's been very influential in their BMW Group's program on designing and engineering and ultimately what's become of the Mini Cooper SE, which we had brought over to our track in North Carolina. And Tom and I spent some time on track with that car. And we ran into a couple problems. I think the chassis is set up, of course, for daily driving. I have a full track review up on Honda Spec Reviews. And we also found that that car had a lot of thermal limitations when driving aggressively. So I'm an ex Mini John Cooper Works GP owner. I had a R56 generation car. This is the F56, the next generation. And now it is electric. If they make this car, it will be in my driveway. This is everything I love about motoring because it's premium. They're designed and engineered by really, really talented engineers, and it's going to be electric, and it's the fast one. I love everything about it. You can see my Mini posters here. I have a Mini shrine over there, and finally we get the JCW GP going electric. Hopefully we'll see this come to production. Again, I'm not sure how many people are like me out there, but I do know that this would be a great story for electric cars all around to have a hot hatch that's truly a hot hatch. That would be electrified. Literally, it's made for me.
So, but it needs a lot more cooling.
Yeah, it needs more cooling for sure, and it needs faster, probably a little bit more range. I don't know. If you just burn through the battery so fast on track that I doubt you could do two laps of the Nürburgring on a full charge. Maybe two, but nothing more. Not that I am going to take my US car around the Nürburgring, but I will take it around our tracks here and. We'll see. I just think if they can solve the cooling, that's a good first step. Put on the same suspension that's on the normal JCW GP and shred it.
See, look, we're looking at the grill there. It doesn't look like it opens. Like it doesn't look like it has like flaps that open. You know, if you need more cooling, let more air in. So that's kind of bizarre.
Well, yeah, also, the Mini diffuser. It didn't even kick on the fans. So there's potential to cool things more. And I don't think it's the battery that gets hot. I think it's the stator. I think it's in the motor itself.
In the motor.
Yeah. It really just spikes in temperature when you drive it hard. And there's no way to actually jam cooling right to that part. So it needs probably a redesigned motor.
Right. Man, that's Oh, man, don't disappoint us, BMW, who owns Mini. Also, if you look at the rear diffuser on this, has like the little cutout for the exhaust pipes and the center exhaust pipes.
Oh yeah, look,
it's the same one from the gas version, just on this.
Yeah, hopefully they'll have an actual electric vehicle diffuser on the back of that because that helps. That's a you know an element that really helps reduce friction, air friction, helps with the aerodynamics and increase range. So that's
or put one of those little F1 brake lights down there. Would be kind of cool.
Oh yeah, exactly. Right.
I just hope Mini does it right. I hope they don't just, you know, put stickers on it and give it fender flares and, you know, tweak a couple of things here and there and shave, you know, 0.3 of a second off of the Cooper SE's 0-60 time and say, oh, here we go. Here's our performance version. You know, I there's so much potential for a hot hatch, all electric Mini Cooper. I tell you, you know, Kyle mentioned earlier, I had the original Mini E. I drove it for 2.5 years. I love that car. It's what hooked me on electric drive. And it's such a great platform for electrification. Mini should be an all-electric brand. You know, I know they're eventually going to be. It lends itself to it perfectly. I think BMW is waiting till, you know, battery density gets a little bit better. So, don't forget, it's a very small package, so it's hard to put a big enough battery in there to make it go 200, 250 miles or so, whatever they deem to be the minimum of what, you know, a Mini would have to be able to do road trips and so forth and so on. But it's, I tell you, Minis are perfect cars for electrification. They're city cars. the go-kart handling. It's, you're right down on the road. That instant torque makes the car feel even faster because you're sitting so low. And that's what, that's really what, like I said, what hooked me on electrification. Do this right, Mini, please. If you're going to do this, make it a real hot hatch that's that can deal with the thermal issues that the Cooper SE has, and give us something that, you know, people want to drive, not just, you know, it's not a sticker car where you just took an SE and put some stickers on it and fender flares and said, oh, here it is. Do this one right, and people will buy it.
And then make that convertible that you showed us a couple years ago.
Well, I'm still mad at Mini for not making the Rocket Man, the Mini Rocket Man electric concept that they introduced like back in like, I don't know, 2012, 2013.
Yeah, I think it was like 13, 14. Yeah,
Martin might be able to pull right. That would have been such a cool vehicle. That could have been in production by now, and I think people would have loved it.
That was a convertible, right? Rocket Man?
The Rocket Man, I don't think the Rocket Man was a convertible.
Oh, that was the small city car. You're thinking of the Roadster concept thing.
Oh, God. What was the name of it?
I think the point is while you're thinking about that.
The
Super Leggera or something like that.
No, I'm talking about the Rocketman, which was just a small version of a Cooper hardtop. And it was going to be all electric. And it looked so cool.
Look, I think Mini's at its weakest right now. We see aging products. The F56 chassis has been out since 2014 now. We don't see a sales numbers increasing. The Countryman's okay, but it's not amazing. I think right now is probably the softest point for Mini, and they've always been about the driving enthusiast thing. So if they can become and position themselves as the enthusiast back road blaster of the electric car world, cultivate the Mini culture once again around that car, do those fun road trip rally things. Like I did, Mini takes the States a number of times, going cross country with 6,000 Mini Coopers. You know, if they can get the brand back to that point with electric vehicles, I think that's the way to go. But right now we've just seen really a compliance effort for the Mini Cooper SE. It's an okay car, but it's not an amazing EV. And they better knock it out of the park with this GP if they bring it to production.
So is this on a new platform, Kyle?
It's going to be on the same platform based off the concept. It's the F56 ICE platform that has been adapted to a battery electric. It sounds like they're extending that chassis as well for cost. They're going to run that for the next few years, which is fine. Like the gas cars drive really nicely. There's probably not much they could do to make them drive better with the current chassis. I've done probably 100,000 miles in F56 chassis now across a whole bunch of cars. And maybe not that many, maybe 50,000. But they're just a little soft. That's, you know, we missed the days of the R53, the supercharger whine, the real hardcore bouncy, you know, hard rock hard suspension. We just need that, but electrified. And that will be the future of Mini. Otherwise, I don't know what's going to happen to them because at this point they're so expensive.
And the supercharger whine is only going to happen when you're actually like charging it up. But so what Mini needs then basically is a new platform that's, you know, engineered to be electric. If they want to keep any legacy ICE stuff for a while, I'm sure how that will continue to sell for them if they have like a good EV. But definitely that looks like seems to be what they really need. It's like a platform they can shove a lot of batteries into.
Mini hasn't gone in and all in anything. They're taking all their BMW parts over and they've softened up the cars. And so now they're just kind of lukewarm water. They need to be spicy. Put some sriracha in there and make it fun.
Right on. Okay. So let's move on to a couple. We're really over time now. So Ford is expected to produce an MEB-based EVs in Cologne, Germany. So the MEB platform is from Volkswagen. And Ford is making a vehicle on the Volkswagen platform. And there's a possibility now that there might be a second vehicle coming for it as well, because they're not sure they're going to have the volume with just one vehicle. And I believe it's only going to be for Europe as well, which is really disappointing. I don't know. Anyone hear anything about that?
Yeah, I did read that this week. It was one of the senior managers at Ford saying it wasn't a confirmation, but when the journalist put the question of will there be more, it was one of those answers of, well, if you want scale, you have to do more. So a kind of
right.
Implicit yes. So, but it would make sense. It would make sense to if they're going to convert the Cologne factory to make MEB cars, VW will be happy, more license fees. And Ford can stave off some of those CO2 fines that some of the European car makers in Europe, which are going to get more stringent through the decade, they all need to avoid it. But I just, why wouldn't you make global cars? I don't understand. I don't know enough about the automotive industry for them to say, well, it's a European only car. If it's a great car, why can it not be made at some of their US plants?
Right. A scale is so important, and it's, to bring the prices down where people can afford them. Scale is like a big thing, and only selling, this in Europe, this is, Tom was giving Ford lots of kudos for their electrification program. But I think personally, this is where I think they fall down a bit, like the Mustang Mach-E platform seems to be, pretty good, pretty happening. So why don't, I think they have one other vehicle that's going to use that platform, earmarked right now. And then they have the MEB, and then they have the Transit, platform. It's kind of scattered around a bit. It's not focused on a single platform or a single architecture like the way GM is doing it. GM has like a few different platforms maybe, but they have the same motors and batteries going to be going in all of that Ultium branded thing. So we're pretty much out of time, I think. I don't know if anyone had anything else they wanted to say about that. Nope, we're good. Okay. But before we go, I also wanted to mention that Lucid Motors has completed their AMP-1 plant with a production capacity of 30,000 vehicles. So, kudos to Lucid for hanging in there and getting to this stage. It's going to be great to see how that develops over this next little bit. And the Volkswagen i6, ID6, has been spied with minimal camo, and it looks like a long wheelbase ID4. So that's, I don't know if you can pull up a picture of that real quick, the ID6 Volkswagen, which we haven't really heard anything about. I'm not sure if that's based on the rooms concept or which concept that's based on. Anyone know offhand? Nope.
No, okay. Not that one, no.
Yeah, it looks like a decent, what is that? Like a crossover station wagon thing?
Yeah, kind of people carrier kind of thing.
Yeah, it's all right. We'll see how that develops. It's kind of hard to get a real good feel for the character the way it is now. Some of that fascia is probably not going to look like that in the future.
Some interesting politics to throw in this week on Volkswagen Group. The main man at the top of the company asked the company to back him. Not a kind of back me or sack me ultimatum, but such are the fights. Keeps getting voted down by the enormous pressure that the German unions have, and the kind of worker representation. They hold so many votes on the board at the group level. He's becoming increasingly frustrated. Even wrote for, I think it was Handelsblatt, or he wrote for someone, a newspaper, did an opinion piece on the struggles he's having, and just says, look, if this company doesn't make tough decisions, which means reducing the workforce numbers, 600,000 plus people work for the company, then... he's got no interest in, in just having fights for the next few years. So that is unresolved right now, but it's VW have got it all going on. I think we're all fans of what they're doing. It's one to watch. Without him at the top of the company, it would be a different story.
Yes, definitely. And also he's putting Audi at the center of the electrification efforts. So I think a lot of the Audi brand will be developing a lot of the technology, and then the other Volkswagen brands will feed off of that. So that's kind of a big strategy change as well for the VW group.
Mm. Yeah.
He's the moving force behind that as well.
Audi pulled out of Formula E.
Yeah, Volkswagen, right?
Which is weird that they're going to be focused on the performance, electric brand of Volkswagen Group. Yet they're pulling them out of well, Porsche is the ultimate performance, but they've pulled out of Formula E. Pulled out.
So that announcement was made by Audi. The following day, VW Motorsport announced that Volkswagen are pulling out of all motorsport in the future. So there's 170 odd employees of Volkswagen Motorsport, the company. They will be everything they've learned from running things like the IDR up Pikes Peak, Goodwood, etc., will be folded into the bigger company. They're not losing that knowledge, but they are pulling all of their motorsport activities as a group and investing it in EV technology. That's how serious they are about EVs.
Yeah, they should just stick that with making EV motorsports, though. You learn so much out in the real world. You can't, like, as a big company, it's not... From a public perspective, from my perspective, fan of racing, that's no way to do it. You just push, you know, the racing division always leads the company in what you're working on. So push the front line of electric technology out there in the series. We know, you know, some rally series are going full electric here just in 2022. So let's get into that instead of just stopping all motorsport activity.
170 people, you know, that's salaries and, you know, people who run the program and R&D, but still... It's surely that's not the biggest expense that VW could save in order to plow money into EVs. And as Kyle says, it's not about the brand or the marketing and going racing and, you know, people watching it on Sunday and buying a car on a Monday. It's about what you learn as well and pushing things forward. So that was kind of super surprising.
Look at Lucid, for instance, with their battery packs. That, you know, they went to develop.
We're way over time here.
Ativa? Yeah.
Yeah, Dom?
I'm having some technical issues here.
We may be losing Dom, but
I can... oh, no.
Yeah, we went on for too long. Dom's got
his laptop is calling time. It's like, come on, guys,
it says, look, get off.
You've done enough.
There's smoke billowing out here. Yeah. Okay, I think it's working now. If you have any comments about any of the topics on today's show, you can comment on the Inside EVs podcast post, the YouTube comments section, or on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread. Don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Tom Logney is at Tomalog. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily, and Kyle Connor is at Out of Spec. I'm Dominic_Y. Click subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications, and we'll see you all next week. Ciao.